From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. As the 20th century moves through its last two decades, the figure of Sigmund Freud is one of a handful of intellectual presences presiding over Western thought and culture. This, according to Stephen Marcus, a professor of English at Columbia University. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Stephen Marcus wrote a book entitled Freud and the Culture of Psychoanalysis, published in 1984 by George Allen and Unwin. Also participating in the following discussion about Sigmund Freud is Dr. Arnold Cooper, a professor of psychiatry and director of training at the New York Hospital, Cornell Medical Center. Who was Sigmund Freud? Why is he important in the scientific and cultural history of the 20th century? According to Stephen Marcus, Freud's influence contributes to contemporary understanding of medicine and the biological sciences, the study of sleep and dreaming, infantile and childhood development and human sexuality, as well as the non-medical branches of psychotherapy. But Freud also exerts an influence upon philosophical inquiry, ways of knowing and interpreting human experience. Here to begin the Soundings discussion about Freud and the culture of psychoanalysis is Dr. Arnold Cooper.
Let me take a step back to where Freud began, thinking about his role in culture, and he described psychoanalysis as the third great narcissistic wound to mankind. And what he meant was that Copernicus came along and told people that the Earth was not the center of the universe. Along came Darwin and said man was descended from the lower animals. Uh-huh. And along came Freud and said man is not even master in his own house. He's being driven by forces that he doesn't control and doesn't know his own intentions. I think he was right. That is a great wound. No one likes to hear that they don't run their own show, that they have an unconscious which determines things that they don't know about. And I think one of the ways that that finding, which is painful, has been dealt with is to trivialize it. Mm-hmm. And to talk about slips of the tongue, which usually gets a giggle, or to talk about something sexual, which usually gets a laugh, and to ignore the real meanings of what the Freudian revolution was about, mm-hmm. which is to give us a new vision of what our minds are all about and what our behavior is determined by.
Stephen Marcus, Dr. Cooper has just talked about forces that we have inherited, as it were, from Freud. Are these all sexual? What are these forces? What is Freudianism?
They're certainly not all sexual, although sexuality is very important. Perhaps we should step back think of psychoanalysis the way Freud did. And let me begin by saying what Freud himself remarked on the subject. He defined or described psychoanalysis as being three things. One, a general theory of the human mind. Mm-hmm. Two, a mode of inquiry or investigation. And three, and in his mind in some ways the least important, a therapy. Now, that seems to me to be a fairly good description of the range or the compass of psychoanalysis.
How do we think of him today? Do we still treat Freud in those terms, Dr. Cooper? Which does one of them necessarily predominate?
At the present time in the popular mind, the therapeutic aspect predominates. I think for many analysts, perhaps increasingly so, the idea of analysis as a mode of research, a method of inquiry into the introspective aspects of mind, is enormously important. And for, I think, many people in the culture at large, the idea of a theory of the mind, a mentalist model of how we work, and really the most comprehensive, right or wrong, but the most comprehensive model of the mind that anyone has devised, those are perhaps the most important aspects, uh-huh. the therapeutic aspects derived from those two. Let me take a step back, because what Freud did in a way was to codify the way people have always thought of the mind to the extent that they thought about it. He mm-hmm. described people as being motivated towards the things that they do, and he described what are the basis for motivations. Mm-hmm. He described people as being in conflict. They usually have in mind several things at the same time, not always clear which one they really want to carry out. Their motives conflict with each other. And he described people as being motivated to do things that they don't know that they are motivated towards. Mm-hmm. So that behind all kinds of activities lie other kinds of intentions, perhaps being satisfied secretly. That idea of multiple activities mm-hmm. being carried out at the same time was a very important part of it. Mm-hmm. He also set the stage for scientific study of the mind. He had a concept that he called psychic determinism, and he said that the things that people do, the products of mental behavior, are subject to order. They are not random. They can be understood as having cause and effect sequences. And he said that gives us permission then to study. Those were the core aspects mm-hmm. of what he set up as his model of the mind. Then from that derived a whole series of changing models, of which the structural theory, ego, id, mm-hmm. superego, was one. And there are other models that we can get into if you wish.
Let's come back to the ways that we use and talk about these models and their derivations in just a few minutes. Stephen Marcus, you had a comment.
Yeah, that what Freud gave us is the first or the current most comprehensive theory of psychology that we have. It's the most general, large-scale psychology that exists now. And there were certain other elements that went into it as well, which correspond to that part of Freud's mind which had a scientific ambition to it, since he had a very complex mind, part of which was scientific in its ambitions and part of which were extra-scientific. And the first one of these, which I think was very important, is that Freud installed the notion that introspection or self-examination could be something like a scientific activity, mm-hmm. That it was not simply contemplation or philosophical, but could be, as it were, brought within the constraints of what was thought of as science.
He was legitimizing it after a fashion, is that right?
Legitimizing it and formalizing it in a certain way and subjecting it to kinds of checks and controls that it had not been formally. Now, self-examination is a very profound part of the Western tradition, mm-hmm. beginning with the Greeks. But what Freud did was to bring the whole idea of introspection or self-examination to a new level of discourse.
Mm-hmm. Arnold Cooper?
Just to add that, I think Stephen has put his finger on an important aspect of it, but he didn't just formalize it, he really made a discovery. It was really Breuer, his early collaborator, who made the discovery, that there is a way of understanding people's unconscious trains of thoughts. There's a way of communicating introspection and then subjecting that to a kind of scrutiny from which one can derive scientifically legitimate conclusions.
Can you give me some shorthand there, Dr. Arnold Cooper, ways of understanding? Are we back to this notion of models and constructs of the mind?
Sure. Everything that is understood through some model or other. Uh-huh. And when Freud started out, his first model of how things work was that if you make the unconscious conscious, that will produce profound effects, and indeed it does. And then he went on to another, so the first model of what a therapeutic goal in analysis would be was exactly making the unconscious conscious. He then developed a second model and said, where id was, there shall ego be. And what he meant there was that we should help people to escape from their more primitive impulses and to establish better mechanisms of control and expression. And probably most analysts today would say, still a different model, and say that what analysis is intended to do is to help people to reorder the internal representations in their mind of what the world is about, the internal representations of other persons. Mm-hmm. So there's a continuing shift of models that goes on.
Stephen Marcus?
Yeah, I think another thing that Freud did was to bypass one of the problems that's plagued Western thinking, which is the split between mind and body. Uh-huh. In Freud's thinking, there was no such split because he located his thinking directly on the line that separates mind and body. And indeed, his first cases and where he made his first great discoveries were in fact with people, namely people suffering from hysteria, who were suffering from somatic symptoms such as paralysis, deafness, blindness, lameness, and a variety of physical symptoms which had, in fact, psychic or mental causes. If we think of art or literature or education or child-rearing or sexuality or the relations between men and women, there's no area there where Freud has not had a profound effect. Mm-hmm. That is to say, his effect has been as great as that of any thinker that one can imagine in the modern world.
All right, now Stephen Marcus has just ticked off a list there, culture and education and sex, and I would take it that implicit there is one's relationship with one's parents and the whole idea of personal history. Why why has Freud taken, as it were, a bum rap in the sense that we think of him primarily in sexual terms? Dr. Cooper?
He's taken a bum rap only to the extent that most people are stuck with a version of Freud which was true in about 1890 mm-hmm. and hasn't been true really certainly since 1910. Freud began with the notion that at the root of all human behavior was something sexual. Now, one has to understand that when Freud said sex, he didn't mean what the man in the street means when he says sex. Freud included under sexuality a very broad array of all the pleasurable activities. So Freud regarded that the human being is driven towards almost any activity by the tendency towards extending his pleasure and avoiding pain. Mm-hmm. And that extension of pleasure, that seeking of pleasure, Freud broadly called sexual. That's not the definition that's meant by ordinary speech. Mm-hmm. That initial version of Freud's, which was already misunderstood, was then vastly modified when Freud changed what was called his instinct theory, and introduced aggression. And then he said people are motivated by two drives, one sexual, the other aggressive, and combinations of those can be used to explain any behavior. Hmm. That then became modified when he introduced the idea of narcissism, the idea that people have a self, and as analysis has developed, there's been much greater attention paid to what are the needs that the self develops. And today, people have whole arrays of complex versions of how motivations arise. Mm-hmm. So the idea that Freud was monomaniacally interested in sexuality, or that psychoanalysis is a single-order theory of human behavior, was outmoded almost from the very beginning, and Freud himself protested that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Arnold Cooper from the Cornell University Medical Center, Stephen Marcus from Columbia University. Our topic is Freud and the culture of psychoanalysis. Let me be utterly naive. Was Freud right? How do we figure out that he was right? How has he come to us in the 1980s? And how do you two, as a medical professional and a scholar of culture and literature, how do you figure out that what he said was right and that what we have done with him is the best thing? Dr. Cooper?
Let's begin with which Freud we're talking about when we say, was he right? Was he right in the claim that the dynamic unconscious, as he referred to it, the idea that people are motivated in ways that they don't know about by all kinds of desires which they don't know about, that those are major determinants of behavior? Yes, I think he was right, and we see that in any investigation of introspective life. Mm-hmm. As Professor Marcus pointed out, the great writers always knew that, and that's what makes great writing interesting, is hidden motivations. He was right in the sense that we can use introspection as a tool for studying how the mind works and learn things that we didn't know. And that's been one of the great achievements through psychoanalysis, is the application of this method of investigation to a whole array of fields that were never dreamt of in those terms before. He was right in insisting that what goes on in our early lives, the sexual aspect as well as the aggressive aspect, the relational aspects, the ways in which we relate to those about us in early life, color our lives forever afterwards. And you can't understand an adult without understanding something about mm-hmm. his early life. So he was right in many of the major propositions that he put forward, and they have not only endured, they have been enormously elaborated and extended. Freud himself was very clear on what he was wrong on early. When he changed, for example, his concept of motivation to say that everything can't be sexual. We have to find room for other kinds mm-hmm. of motivation, such as aggression. Freud was also very clear on what in his theory was disposable, such as, for example, the idea of ego, id, superego. These are terms that help to talk about things that were of interest, but there's nothing holy about those.
He himself, in other words, didn't chisel them in granite. He was, as it were, open-minded. Stephen Marcus?
He was entirely open-minded. In fact, the system is open-ended in the sense that the higher levels, or the metapsychology, is always open to revision and change. The terminology is very flexible, although somehow not easy to get rid of. I would go back to one other thing that he was right about, and Dr. Cooper mentioned it earlier, and that's the notion of psychic determinism, which is connected with his idea of overdetermination as well, which means that every mental act not only has one cause, but several causes. And what this implies is that nothing that happens in one's mind is accidental or gratuitous. Every mental act has some meaning, too. And in Freud's insistence that all mental activity had a meaning, it seems to me he was striking gold there, because he's one of the first, or the first psychologist, to say that nothing that happens in the mind is either accidental or without meaning. And this gave him an enormous purchase, as it were, on trying to deal with things which seem to have no meaning, like slips of the tongue, or dreams, or the various kinds of mistakes that we make, or very foolish things, you know, like neurotic behavior, compulsive washing of hands, you know, or scratching one's head, or things like that. So it was for it was Freud's belief that nothing was without meaning that led him to investigate these apparently strange and meaningless things, and that in a circuitous way led him to some very central discoveries about the mind.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the first segment in a two-part discussion about Sigmund Freud and the culture of psychoanalysis. The Soundings panelists are Stephen Marcus of Columbia University and Dr. Arnold Cooper, a professor of psychiatry and director of training at the New York Hospital, Cornell Medical Center. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Stephen Marcus completed his book, Freud and the Culture of Psychoanalysis, published in 1984 by George Allen and Unwin. According to Stephen Marcus, Freud's contributions to 20th century science and culture embrace an immense variety of disciplinary and professional intellectual activities. Freud is also noteworthy as a writer whose commentary is important to contemporary understanding of the narration and interpretation of human experience.
Stephen Marcus from Columbia University, Arnold Cooper from Cornell Medical Center. Our topic is Freud and the Culture of Psychoanalysis. Stephen, tell me about what the literary influence, the literary what subtext or subculture, or there's nothing sub about it. It is all around us. How does Freud come to us in those terms?
Well, he comes to us in a very complex way. As Dr. Cooper mentioned already, Freud acknowledged that the poets and novelists had intuitive awareness of his own insights.
He didn't see himself as an inventor, necessarily.
He didn't even see himself as a great discoverer. He thought of himself, he said, characteristically, as a conquistador, as somebody who had the aggressiveness and the willpower to confront other people with unpleasant truths about themselves. He was a great discoverer, but he didn't make himself out to be a great discoverer. Now, he also felt sheepish in a way, because his own writings had such an extraordinary literary quality to them. And he apologized for this. He said, "I'm sorry that my case histories turn out to sound like stories, rather short stories, rather than scientific accounts."
Now, that's a wonderful convenience for literary theory today, isn't it?
Oh, and it's a wonderful confession on his part. That is to say, scientific insights were coming to him and were being expressed by him in a form that was recognizably literary. Too. And this is, of course, part of the complexity of his talent and genius, too. Now, what happened is that Freud was immediately read by lots of writers, lots of artists, novelists and poets and so on, and they naively picked up what they could pick up on a first reading. But what happened is that is very interesting. After Freud published his writings, writers could no longer rely upon their naivete about life the way they could before Freud had made his discoveries. So
they had a backdrop, in other
they
words.
They had a backdrop, and they couldn't say the kinds of things that they were free to say before Freud wrote about the unconscious and about the eatable situation and things like that. So writers began to incorporate their knowledge of Freud into their own writing, and it's hard to read modern novelists today without being aware that Freud is very much somewhere in their minds.
Dr. Cooper?
Just to elaborate a bit of what Professor Marcus has just talked about, a couple of historical notes I think are important. One is that Freud was proudest, in a way, of having solved the riddle of the Sphinx, as he saw it.
Yeah.
what is the nature of man? And that's what he wanted, really, to be marked by. So he did regard himself as the solver of the central puzzles of humankind. It's, I think, also interesting to note that Freud was not a psychiatrist. Freud was a neurologist. Freud didn't begin his life working with mental patients. He began trying to solve the problems of people who were then appearing in neurologist's office with hysteria, the common neurotic complaint of the day, although not regarded as neurosis until Freud and Breuer began to make their discoveries. Freud regarded himself from the start as a literary person, and part of his importance was that Freud in some ways incorporated within himself the entire culture of the time. He was an extremely well-trained scientist who had made major scientific discoveries in neurology. He was an extraordinarily well-read person who knew all of the literature of his time. And his own ambition early on was clearly to be a literary figure. And psychoanalysis is marked by these multiple goals of this very complex genius.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Marcus?
Yeah, I think that this brings us to an important point about psychoanalysis itself, which is the kind of theory of knowledge or epistemology that was set up by it, because it's one of the...
What you're talking about now are ways of knowing things.
Ways of knowing. Mm-hmm. Because the way that one knows in psychoanalysis or the epistemological setup is that the observer becomes as important as that which is observed. That is, the psychoanalyst and his own mental functioning becomes as important as the object, the patient that he's talking about. And what this indicates is the dual nature of psychoanalysis, that it has one foot planted in the sciences and another foot planted in the disciplines of interpretation. That is to say, the hermeneutic disciplines, which are the humanities of various kinds. So it is both an interpretative and a scientific discipline, both at the same time and not equally. Sometimes it's one and sometimes it's the other.
Are we uncomfortable with that today? Stephen Marcus, you're a literary and cultural scholar. Arnold Cooper, you're a professor of psychiatry at Cornell. Are you telling me that Freud for us is a means and not an end? And to think of him in terms of psychiatric or scientific or mental goals is wrong, that we should think of him as steps in a process?
Again, I would take the view that it's both and, not either or.
All right.
He is a means towards doing all kinds of things, and certainly a means towards a new method of interpretation, which was never available in the world before. Uh-huh. And there's a tension in the field, as I said, about how much it is an emphasis on interpretation versus how much is scientific discovery. But there are end products. We do learn things. We do conduct treatments, not only psychoanalysis itself, which is a relatively rarely conducted treatment, but a whole range of modern psychotherapies derived from psychoanalysis are based upon analytic theory. They've been enormously fruitful, as analysis has been. And increasingly now, in what seems to be a biological era of psychiatry, the biologists are now beginning to recognize that they can't work without a good knowledge of the mind, and still the best model of the mind is the psychodynamic model devised by Freud. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we're in an era of alternatives. We're beginning to produce more and more complex syntheses.
Stephen Marcus.
Well, I would say that it has to be both and. I mean, there have been certain things that psychoanalysis has actually led us to know, such as certain things about dreaming, certain things about infant behavior, certain things about infant development, which are as well established, as it were, as scientific findings as these things can be. That is to say, they're there, they're hypotheses, they've been, they're observational and sometimes theoretical hypotheses, they're there to be falsified, and they change, so that it answers to what we think of as science. Other things are clearly interpretive and hermeneutic, such as what happens when, in the relation between the analyst and the patient, when the patient constructs or reconstructs his history, because there is a whole question, there's another one of the things that's changed within the history of psychoanalysis. Freud began by saying what a patient has to do in therapy is to reconstruct his history, that is to say, to get his story straight to be able to tell, a coherent story, a coherent narrative, was the equivalent of achieving mental health.
Is this shorthand for stop lying to ourselves?
Not only that, it's partly that we all do lie to ourselves, but it's also it also is recovering things that have been repressed, that is to say, put away, forgotten with a purpose, discovering things about oneself that one has hidden from oneself, that is to say, why one does certain things, which are uncontrollably, let's say, why one drinks uncontrollably sometimes, or why one can't cross the street, at another, or why one treats one's wife or children in a certain way. And this has changed in the course of generations from Reconstruction, that is to say, getting your story actually historically straight, to, as it were, more of construction rather than reconstruction. That is to say, in the course of the analysis, the patient doesn't so much act as a historian and archivist and to go back and recovering as constructing a story which is satisfactory and coherent for both himself and his analyst for the first time. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't so much matter whether you got it historically correct as that you've got it coherently correct and satisfactory to yourself.
What one is looking for, really two things. One is that something is a bit more coherent than the previous story. Mm-hmm. But what the analyst is always looking for is where in the story things don't hold together. Uh-huh. And he's much less interested in coherence than in the areas of incoherence. And by focusing always on what doesn't fit, the story keeps changing. And when Freud wrote a paper called Analysis Terminable and Interminable, what he's referring to was that there is no end to that process. Uh-huh. We always have defense mechanisms. We're always, as you put it, lying to ourselves. That's putting it, one has to understand that's an unconscious process. Uh-huh. And so that never stops. And so there are always discrepancies in the story. And if you follow them through, you get a different version of the story. We don't know where to end that.
Stephen Marcus.
Yeah, I would say that at the moment the current emphasis is on construction, because that goes along with the hermeneutic epistemology that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. At the same time, one mustn't overlook the fact that the past actually did happen. And does exist. Now, that's an inconvenience for the coherence theory, but nevertheless, it's actually true. One can't, as it were, entirely discard the fact that there was a past and that it did exist and that something actually happened in the past. So that we need both of these.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the first of two discussions about Sigmund Freud and his importance to 20th century science and culture. The Soundings panelists were Stephen Marcus, a professor of English at Columbia University, and Dr. Arnold Cooper, a professor of psychiatry and director of training at the New York Hospital, Cornell Medical Center. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Stephen Marcus completed his book, Freud and the Culture of Psychoanalysis, published in 1984 by George Allen and Unwin. Next week on Soundings, Stephen Marcus and Arnold Cooper conclude their discussion about Sigmund Freud. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Freud and the Culture of Psychoanalysis, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for the first of two discussions about Sigmund Freud and the culture of psychoanalysis. Who was Sigmund Freud, and why is he important in the scientific and cultural history of the 20th century? Listen for some answers and insights from Stephen Marcus of Columbia University and Dr. Arnold Cooper of the Cornell University Medical Center. Sigmund Freud and the Culture of Psychoanalysis, Part 1, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.